This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
In the meantime, we are moving to our next story.
So for our next story, we're talking about ASEAN and Australia working together to combat human trafficking in Southeast Asia. This is after the two bodies, ASEAN and Australia, launched a new $80 million counter-trafficking initiative.
So Australia and ASEAN have worked together for something like 15 years to tackle human trafficking. Australia helped to train more than 100,000 judicial officers to strengthen the legal system in ASEAN countries and better protect victims. So this new $80 million program will extend this cooperation for another 10 years. And this is coming at a time where, you know, based on a report by the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, that organized crime syndicates and human trafficking are flourishing in ASEAN, particularly in Malaysia, because of just our geographical location. So after this, we will be speaking to Phil Robertson, Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch's Asia Division, to get some more info about this initiative. You're listening to The Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Because freedom matters, BFM 89.9.
It's 7:13, you're listening to The Evening Edition with Kelvin, Ayman and Cam. And we've been talking about how Australia and ASEAN is working together to combat human trafficking in Southeast Asia. They've launched a new $80 million counter-trafficking initiative. So we now have on the line Phil Robertson, Deputy Director for the Asia Division at Human Rights Watch. Phil, thank you so much for joining us today. So at the launch of the initiative, Marissa Payne, the Australian Foreign Minister, said that the scale of the human trafficking problem remains immense in the region. How much further do you think we have to go in tackling this issue?
Well, it's important to understand that when you talk about human trafficking, it occurs in the context of migration. And there's many undocumented migrants that are moving from different parts of the region to other countries. So for instance, in Malaysia, there are many people from Thailand, Cambodia, Vietnam who are going to work in Malaysia, as well as people from South Asia. There are Burmese, Lao, and Khmer coming into Thailand. There's a lot of people on the move. And what we're seeing is exploitation in the context of both movement and employment. There are significant areas of work outside the formal sector. They're totally unregulated. We see a lot of cheating brokers and manpower agencies and people being sent from one country to another in debt bondage. And often that debt bondage then descends into forced labor and abuse. There's also instances of people being taken advantage of, women and children in particular, sometimes for the use as forced labor, sometimes, sex trafficking. There's a whole bunch of different variations. But the reality is that the borders are largely porous in this region. People are able to move, and trafficking is a oftentimes migration gone wrong, that migrants are particularly the people who are targeted by the traffickers.
So what can we expect to come up from this $80 million initiative over the next 10 years?
The Australian anti-trafficking programs over the last 15 or so years in the region have always really focused on criminal justice response. They're working with the police, they're working with the prosecutors, and they're working with the judges. What is different this time is they're now really taking up the discussion about joint investigations. And if that could happen, that would be huge. What we have seen consistently is when there's trafficking investigations taking place, those trafficking investigations often stop at the border, even though there are various memorandums of understanding and other agreements between countries. They're not really effectively implemented. And, it would be great, for instance, if there was a way that someone who was trafficked in Thailand from Cambodia, that there would be information sharing and witness sharing, and that the Cambodian and Thai police could work together, or that Thai and Malaysian police could work together, that the prosecutors could share evidence. But today we've just not seen this. The judicial systems of these various countries remain siloed. They remain sort of apart from each other. And the cooperation is very formulaic and frankly, quite limited. And so it's important that Australia try to break that down and and ensure that there's a more modern cross-border response to these cross-border crimes of trafficking.
What's keeping us from moving towards strategies that are more likely to achieve a greater level of success?
I think that it's just a very conservative, traditional way of doing things in many of these judicial cooperation. You know, for instance, often they will say that unless a witness is sitting right in front of us, their testimony doesn't count. Or, you know, we're not going to allow an affidavit or a statement from a witness taken in another country to be used in our court. You know, these kind of very archaic rules and responses by judges and the prosecutors are what prevent more effective cross-border trafficking response. And, you know, the police are the same way. The police oftentimes are very jealous in guarding their turf. They're not willing to share information. They don't know how to operate across the border. They don't have good liaison with other police forces in other countries, except beyond the very sort of formal top-level cooperation and visits that happen. And the reality is then that the case by case, the cooperation doesn't happen the way it would have to for effective anti-trafficking response to be created between countries.
And how do you think that can be achieved with this initiative? Or is that existing situation you've described just difficult to change?
Well, I mean, what I'm hoping with these funds from Australia are able to do is that because they're able to fund anti-trafficking efforts, that we will see some real test cases, some cases where two police forces are working a case together, or two prosecutors' offices from different countries are collaborating on the same prosecution. A lot of times what we get is, you know, people saying, for instance, in Thailand, well, we'd like to go get information about what had happened to this person and how they got here from Cambodia, from Myanmar. But we don't have the budget. And we hear this from the Cambodian police, or we hear this from the Vietnam police, that, yeah, we'd like to do more, we'd like to follow up, but we don't have any budget, we don't have any support. And so hopefully there will be a way that, you know, the money can be used with reform efforts to ensure that there are some real cases that come out, and that, you know, there's a demonstration effect that once a successful prosecution occurs with, you know, two different governments working together in a more systematic way, that people realize, hey, we should have been doing this all along, and let's figure out how to do it in a more sustainable way going forward.
Are there examples in other parts of the world where cooperation has been more successful in tackling human trafficking?
Sure, it happens in the European Union all the time. You know, it happens cross-border in North America and parts of Latin America as well. You know, I mean, the problem is, frankly, that there just has not been an emphasis placed on combating these crimes. Oftentimes, the people who are the victims of human trafficking are very poor. You know, they're not influential persons. These are people who, you know, are really migrating from one country to another to, you know, try to seek enough money to help their families and help them survive. And when something happens to them, they just disappear from the face of the earth, frankly. I mean, they're not people that come up on the radar of the police or the prosecutors unless somehow there's a rescue at the point of exploitation. And then, you know, some of these systems kick in where you see cooperation taking place between countries is support for trafficking victims and repatriation of trafficking victims from one country to another. So people who are trafficking victims in Thailand are ultimately sent back to places like Laos or Myanmar or Cambodia or Vietnam. And there are arrangements for those kind of returns to take place. But, you know, when you talk about prosecution, the cooperation is really at a much lower level.
But have you seen any progress in the way we address trafficking?
Well, I think that there's much more acceptance of using a victim-centric approach, you know, ensuring that the rights of the victims are placed at the center of intervention, recognizing that these people are victimized and they need to be supported and assisted, that, you know, ultimately criminal justice and rehabilitation programs really need to be centered around what the interests of the victims are. So, you know, understanding that there's a victim-centric approach, I think, has been an important step forward for the region. I think that we've also seen a greater public understanding about human trafficking. You know, so many of these prevention efforts to try to explain to people that there is this danger of human trafficking and you have to be aware of these dangers, and that if you're migrating or if you're, you know, moving around, if you're basically seeking work in another country, or even if you're moving from a rural area in the country to the cities, that you have to be careful. You have to let people know what you're doing and where you're going. You have to stay in touch with your relatives and friends, and you need to recognize that there are people out there that are prepared to take advantage of people and try to put them in systems of bondage, forced labor, and sexual slavery. But these realities, I think, have now been better explained to people, but there's still a lot more work to be done. I think that there's still work that needs to be done to take down some of these coordinated networks that are trafficking people, especially the ones that are working across border. So far, the criminal justice response to those kind of regional networks on human traffickers has been much less satisfactory. It's ultimately important as well when we talk about ASEAN. I mean, there's, you know, this ASEAN action plan on human trafficking. Unfortunately, there hasn't been much action. You know, ASEAN action plans, like ASEAN themselves, you know, it's a lot of talk and not so much action. And I think it's important that Australia really ensure that its assistance be something that works on specific cases and results in demonstration effect, the sort of thing that we would say that, you know, shows good practice, that if people are working together and if states are working together, that actually effective prosecution can take place.
One last question before you go, Phil. You mentioned a victim-centric approach. Could you tell us what that would look like in terms of cooperation between different nations?
Well, when you talk about a victim-centric approach, it really means ensuring that the victim themselves is fully consulted and is part of the discussion of what's going to happen next. That, you know, they need to be a decision maker in how their case is handled. That, you know, they're not just sort of shunted off to a shelter and told to wait there while a prosecution goes forward, and that they can't go home because they have to be a witness in a prosecution they don't want to be involved in. I mean, oftentimes what we've seen is in the past cases where, you know, victims of trafficking ended up staying in shelter for a year or two while there was a legal investigation going on and a prosecution being considered. You know, we just have not seen the kind of sensitivity that we needed, at least at the start of the century when we were talking about human trafficking. I think now we're seeing more work being done to understand that victims are, you know, critical to any sort of anti-trafficking response. That, you know, a willing witness who is prepared to testify is the most persuasive witness, and not someone who feels that they've been pushed to do this. And that, you know, this Australian money may, in some ways, I think, help with that, because they're talking about ensuring that there are victim-friendly arrangements in the courts. And particularly child-friendly arrangements in the courts for people to testify, so that, you know, they are able to, on one hand, give evidence, but at the other time, not be re-traumatized by the experience.
Phil, thank you for speaking with us today. That was Phil Robertson, Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch's Asia Division, talking to us about this new $80 million Australian dollar counter-trafficking initiative. And we're just going to wrap up some of the messages we've been receiving about the whole issue surrounding introducing the CART as a syllabus in the in Bahasa Malaysia. So Ms. Goh says, I'm 50 and was from SRJK and SMJK. I remember we had Jawi classes in primary school, and I remember Alif, Ba, and Ta. Are those the foundations of that course?
Yeah, so there's the three the first three alphabets. But it just shows that, you know, some people do remember when they learn it, unlike what Kevin said earlier.
So we have this message from Shamil that says, Jawi is a way to write in Malay. Hence, it's in Bahasa Melayu syllabus. A lot of Malaysia's historical documents and stuff, such as Batu Bersurat, was written in Jawi. If we leave Jawi behind, nobody can translate it anymore in the next 25 years. Do you know Jawi doesn't work like Arabic? So those Arabs can't read Jawi.
Is this true, Ayman? Is this true?
Oh yeah, definitely. It's like trying to read Farsi. It's the same letters, but it's all gibberish because it's a completely different language. And yeah, I do agree with that. So maybe in 50 years' time or whatever, we may find a new historical document or another important artifact from the past. And if no one can read it, then, you know, we lose the understanding of who we are.
And people have to find you. They have to track you down.
Yeah. Oh, boy, I wish I learned Khat, man.
Doesn't that work to your advantage that you are, like, the last person who can speak Jawi?
I'm, like, the last person who can work at VCR. One day it'll come in useful.
We have this, well, from a different perspective. Yours says, went to Chinese primary school and continued to take Chinese language papers up to SPM level. Chinese ink calligraphy was part of our PMR papers. Apart from making an absolute mess and bearing with the stench of the ink, it did absolutely nothing for deeper cultural appreciation, my culture, mind, and neither did my penmanship and anger control improve. Does CART foster unity? Does it aid PM learning? Will it improve our math and science rankings?
That's a great point. The practicality of it, you know, as well.
Well, for me, I just wonder if there is, like, you know, you don't realize the value of something you've learned sometimes until certain situations call for it, or you don't realize that the core of the fundamentals you've learned from a certain subject somehow come up in certain work instances, right? I'm, you know, if it's really to teach about cultural appreciation, or if it's to teach anger control in this instance, whether or not that translates in some ways that you can't imagine.
Yeah, and I agree with what you said, Kelvin, that something that we learn when we were young, sometimes never comes up ever in our lives, except for this one particular moment in the future when suddenly, oh, good thing I learned this. So it may come in handy, who knows?
Last two messages about priority, both MZ and CG have said, you know, it's MOE so far is focusing on the nice to have instead of the need to have. Maybe it's time to focus their priority, and then... you know, we mentioned the lack of resources. Why do we focus on these non-value-added decisions? We should focus on things which bring value in the 21st century.
This is a very common response, isn't it? Mm-hmm. The idea of the utilitarian aspect of education, that it's all leading to a purpose. It's about utility. It's not about entertaining the child, actually, mm-hmm. quite frankly, along their journey and trying to help them become a fuller person.
Yeah, because we've been talking about having a more holistic education, because we were talking about sports earlier, and it's not necessarily about achieving an aim, a specific aim, but it's just about making you a more a fuller person, really.
Everyone, thank you so much for your messages. Cam, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
So keep it here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my. BFM 89.9, the business station.